From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is expected to be made early this year when new affordable housing is set to open in the Tremont neighborhood of the Bronx. Cretona Senior Residences will feature 83 apartments, and its inhabitants will be couples 62 and older who identify as LGBTQ. It's a project through SAGE, Senior Action in a Gay Environment, a national organization dedicated to improving the lives of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender older adults. According to the American Psychological Association, 2.4 million people age 65 or older in the U.S. identify as LGBTQ. The association, along with SAGE and other organizations, has pushed for services and caregiving that are sensitive to the histories and concerns of LGBTQ seniors. One of those concerns is housing. Fair housing, free from discrimination on the basis of sexual identity. The Human Rights Campaign reports that 60% of LGBTQ elders are worried about how they will be treated in long-term care settings. Some say they feel they must choose between hiding their sexual identity or being open about it, with the hope that fellow residents will not discriminate against them. Fellow residents and also people who run the housing agency. So, as the generation that was the force behind Gay Pride ages, what can be done to help protect and celebrate them when it comes to housing opportunities? Our guests this hour help us understand the issue and progress within it from different angles. Joining us in studio, Nate Sweeney is here, Vice President of Skilled Services at St. John's Home. Tell us about what you do there first, by the way. And welcome, by the way. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
Tell us about some of the work you do.
Sure. So at St. John's Home, I am the Vice President of Skilled Services, meaning I'm the administrator of the nursing home and have oversight of our adult medical day program. And then have a direct connection to our greenhouse residents out in Penfield.
All right. Very good. Sandra Eamon is a resident of St. John's Meadows there. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here. I have been at the Meadows at St. John's for 4 years with my partner of almost 27 years, Ginny. And we have really been, I don't like to be tolerated. We've been accepted and included, and I value and cherish that.
You're going to hear Sandra hit on this theme, I think, throughout this hour, which is important. We're moving past tolerance as being enough, and we're moving toward inclusion, what that actually, and celebration, and what that looks like. And Steve Giroux is here, Executive Director of the National Coalition Building Institute in Rochester. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, and I'm wearing a couple of hats today, Evan. The first one is as an Executive Director of an organization that promotes diversity, inclusion, and equity in all kinds of community environments. And the second, as a member of the LGBTQ community, and I have been with my partner for 32 years and married for 8 years, given New York State marriage equality.
8 years. So right around, and was it 2012, 13?
2011.
2011. I was told there would be no math. Congratulations on 8 years.
Thank you.
But thanks for being here. I appreciate that. When you were together in your earlier years, did you think of a future in which housing, you know, did you think about opportunities in your future? Did you think that inclusion beyond tolerance would be an option, or did it feel different 3 decades ago, Steve?
Well, it really wasn't an issue for us. We were happy to be together, happy to afford housing
sure.
where we wanted to be, and those were not things that were on our mind. I will say this, that the home we purchased was from a couple who were in their 80s, and they were facing the kind of thing that we are going to be facing before too long ourselves.
They were, well, explain a little bit more about that.
There were health problems for both people, and navigating stairs, getting through narrow doorways and things of that sort were an issue. Driving became an issue, all of those things that when you live in the suburbs and you live on a tract or in another kind of environment, make it difficult for you to be able to stay in place.
Nate, tell us about the mission of making sure, especially we're focusing this hour on the LGBTQ community, making sure the mission of making sure that everyone has an opportunity to have the kind of housing that, as Sandra says, is not just sort of tolerated, but better than that, celebrated and included.
Yeah, so I think across the nation, you're really seeing varying levels of what Sandra was describing. The community here in Rochester may be much further along than other communities. And there's a lot of attention on a national scale, a policy scale, really trying to look to see what can be done to make sure that people's rights are celebrated, that people's rights are respected. But there's also been some rollback of those rights. So it takes constant monitoring by the community, by activists in the community, to make sure that what people want to be able to do in order to live their life, be comfortable, be safe in, psychologically, emotionally, are being attended to.
Well, the Fair Housing Act passed more than 50 years ago. LGBTQ citizens remain vulnerable when it comes to fair housing. And according to Sage, 21 states and localities, 21, offer fair housing protections to the LGBTQ community. Why is it 21 and not 50? Why is that number less than half?
Sure. The simple answer is that there remains homophobia across the country. Part of the plight of LGBTQ elders, in my opinion, is that there is rampant homophobia in our country that has gotten better, but still has a ways to go. But within the LGBT community, there's an enormous amount of ageism. We tend, as a community, to focus on, issues that affect youth, that certainly LGBTQ youth are very vulnerable and pull to the heartstrings of many people, but to also realize that our ability to care for those youth exists because of the work of the elders in our community and what they've done to move the conversation forward.
So you sit on an advisory board that's working on issues like this. Tell us about some of the work that you're doing.
Sure, absolutely. So SAGE, the group that you mentioned earlier, has partnered with the Human Rights Campaign, HRC. They're the blue and yellow equal sign stickers, if people aren't familiar with the name, that you might see on cars around town. And they have partnered together to create what is called the Long-Term Care Equality Index. This is modeled after the Corporate Equality Index and the Healthcare Equality Index that the Human Rights Campaign had previously put together. So with the Corporate Equality Index, that really became the way that they could go and have conversations with Coca-Cola, with Ford, and say, what are your workplace discrimination policies? What are you doing in terms of healthcare benefits and equality for the transgender community? That became a way to rank, measure, examine corporate entities across the country. And in a state where you may not have those housing protections, you may not have those workplace protections, at least at those corporations, LGBTQ people would know I could go and work there and have some protections. Similarly, with the Healthcare Equality Index, that was designed for hospitals. And it was really, it began in a time when many hospitals would not allow people to visit their same-sex partner in the hospital. It became, the way to codify the things that needed to be done in order to protect our community, both in terms of visitation, both in terms of continuing education for medical providers. And so what they have done now is they've gathered leaders from long-term care, leaders from the LGBT activist community, and leaders from the long-term care community who are working to help the very challenging work community to evolve. And that tool is going to be the Long-Term Care Equality Index. So over this past summer and fall, folks from across the country have been putting their heads together to try and come up with a measurement tool that will work across a very diverse industry. The tool that would automatically work for an independent living facility may not translate over to assisted living or to skilled nursing. So really trying to hone in as much as they can to make it as an effective tool as possible while still being something that communities are able to participate in.
In a recent video produced by the Human Rights Campaign, the CEO of Charles E. Smith Life Community said he didn't think he'd live to see the moment where something like LEI would be created. Do you share that sentiment?
I've always been a little bit, I won't say I didn't think I would live to see it. I've been excited and waiting for it. I think a lot of people have been waiting for it, but it really took the right moment of leadership and availability, you know, the funding to create something as large as this. You know, there are, I believe it's either 6,000 or 8,000 hospitals across the country, but there are 15,000 nursing homes. There are tens of thousands of assisted livings and tens of thousands of independent living. So the ability to measure and carry all that data is it's a big endeavor.
So I want to get Sandra's story here, because what I want to make sure we kind of understand as we understand this issue is that when Nate says homophobia is still rampant, you know, Sandra's nodding, unfortunately. Sandra's also someone who will tell you that this is a pretty good community in terms of loving and inclusion and acceptance, you know, even beyond tolerance. But that doesn't mean that we're sort of done with homophobia. And I'm curious to know how our guests see it manifest in all levels, especially housing, because we're talking housing this hour. Mm-hmm. So whether it's management, whether it's fellow residents, let's go back a little bit to your story. You've been involved with the Out Alliance for many years. You've been in a long-term relationship. You said it's Ginny. Hello, Ginny.
Ginny, yeah.
And do you see the kind of progress at this point in your life that you expected to maybe decades ago?
I think we have really advanced, and I'd like to personalize this.
Yeah.
Ginny and I went south. Some people came here to speak about a full lesbian women's community near Fort Myers, Florida. So we went. We didn't like it. We wanted diversity.
It was all lesbians?
Yes.
What's wrong with lesbians?
Not a thing. We're wonderful. But all together in a community where there's no diversity, air quotes.
Yeah.
We didn't care for it. We want neighbors with dogs. We want kids and people and speaking different languages. So all that aside, we decided, Ginny is 90, and we shopped around, and I won't mention the names, but we settled on the Meadows some friends from our church invited us to lunch there. They lived at Brickstone, and we were delighted. So that being said, my daughter, the lawyer, said, don't sign anything until I peruse the lease. Well, she called back a day later and said, Mother, there's no anti-discrimination clause in this lease. So I called the person that was in charge of that thing, and I said, hey. And she said, I will bring that to the board immediately. And 2 weeks later, we had a lease with a non-discrimination clause. I love St. John's. And I said to the guys before we started, I play bridge on Saturdays, not always well, but my partner is a Jewish person. On my left is a Catholic, and on my right is a Buddhist. So go figure. We have fun. And I love Rochester because I feel that way, that here we are beyond tolerance. We are accepting and inclusive. And that's my story.
Well, so a couple of things. When did the whole St. John's, with the clause of non-discrimination, how long ago was that?
Oh, 4 years.
Okay, so 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And your experience there sounds like it's been outstanding.
It has been. I can't say anything bad. We have a cottage, and it's near a pond. We have turkeys, deer, foxes, along with neighbors that are on two legs. So it's been a great experience for us there. And going back, when I was 52 years old when I came out. My son came out when he was 16 and my daughter when she was at Nazareth College. So I have it all. I have a straight daughter, a lesbian daughter, and a gay son, and a woman I adopted as a daughter because when she came out, her parents opened the door and said, get out. So she's my daughter. And we love her. I introduce her as my daughter. And my other daughter introduces her as a sister. So it's a Rochester, I would say, is a welcoming community to no matter who you are.
So when it comes to homophobia, you're not experiencing it in your life where you live now. But you're not surprised to hear that across the country, LGBTQ elders are suffering from it in different places. How does it, do you think, it most manifest? What does it really look and feel like, that kind of homophobia and discrimination?
Hurtful. Very hurtful. I feel, too, as you go further south in this country, the homophobia increases.
Geographically?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes. I think it's because we're old that people don't see us as lesbians. They see the young kids. I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but my experience in the gay community is that the younger people are more out and they just don't see us as lesbian women. Some people at St. John's will say, oh, Sandra, where's your partner? And that's all. But I can't, it's changed. Gay community, LGBTQ, however, has changed. It's evolved, I guess is the word I want to use. And I'm all for it. I think it's wonderful. I have not ever, and I don't know if I'm ageist or not, but I think it's because I have white hair and nobody sees me as a lesbian or us as a gay couple because we're 80 and 90.
You came out when you were 52.
Yes.
When did you know you were a lesbian?
I had inklings before then, and I came out through therapy. I was depressed, clinically depressed. I was with a therapist for over a year, and then it was like this great awakening. Oh, my God, I'm a lesbian. And my daughter was upset, but my grandchildren have not known their grandfather. They know Ginny and I as a couple, Amma and Amma. And they're accepted. It's what they were raised with.
It's fascinating to see the current generation of kids, isn't it? Their attitudes and their disposition toward love. I mean, I guess I'm very heartened by it. I'm very encouraged by it. Are you?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Definitely. I think that things are evolving or have evolved already to a good extent. But as I said, the farther south you go, I think there's still a lot of work to be done.
In residence settings, if homophobia is there, are you more likely, you think, to find it among fellow residents or discrimination through management? What would concern you most? If you had to move, for example, what would concern you most?
Oh, that's hard to say without mulling. Mm-hmm. I think it would be the staff would give me the willies, so to speak. I don't think I would go there. And if I had to choose, I don't know. That would be a tough decision. How would you make it?
But when you say that we've got to get beyond tolerance, explain to listeners who've heard for years the importance of tolerance, why tolerance is not good enough to you.
Tolerance is one thing, but acceptance and inclusion go beyond tolerance. You can tolerate a situation, but in the case of other adults, other people, you need to go beyond tolerance and look at acceptance and inclusion and not ask, why are we different? Why are we the same?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, when hiking with my son last spring, got a rash. I tolerated the rash. I didn't have much of a choice. Lesbians are not a rash. I mean, my lesbian friends are friends and neighbors and loved ones and people to celebrate. I hear that. And it's interesting the point that you're making about the way we use that language, tolerance, because there's something limited about just hoping to be tolerated versus truly included and accepted.
Don't tolerate me. Hmm. Accept me or else.
I want Sandra in my family. I want Sandra as a neighbor. Sandra Eamon is one of our guests this hour. She is a resident of St. John's Meadows who, and by the way, I'm hopeful in this community. There are a number of options for LGBTQ elders to find truly accepting housing situations, not just among your fellow residents, but among the staff. I don't know offhand, Nate, if there are those protections written into the document, as Sandra was saying, that her daughter helped arrange. Do you know? I mean, how much protections are there in terms of anti-discrimination?
In terms of specific documents to us or across the state?
I mean, across the state. For LGBTQ elders, if they're looking for communities, places to live, how common are they going to find this kind of protection, a legal protection, or at least a document that says this is an anti-discrimination?
I So I'm a recent New York transplant, and I don't know all of the policy pieces locally, mm-hmm. but I would think that they might be further along than other states. I know federally, there's been some rollback with HUD and with HHS that has been quite concerning for the community in terms of how rules are going to be interpreted. And what's most important about that is, you know, as Sandra was saying, she had a choice of where to go. She was, looking at different communities and picking the one that felt best to her. If someone doesn't have as many means, if someone does not have the same economic opportunities, they're going to be more reliant upon different systems. And if those systems are starting to have rollbacks of their protections, that's very concerning.
Sandra, would you say one of the lessons for listeners who are going to be in the situation of looking for housing situations, you asked the questions, you made sure that the agreements that you were signing had the protections. I mean, you knew to ask, or at least, you worked with, I think you mentioned your daughter. What advice would you give people when they're looking for their own housing arrangements?
Be very careful. And if you have questions, ask an attorney. Ask somebody who knows the system and question, question, question. I'm going to go back, and I like to present this. When I was a nurse working in nursing homes on contract, I had two men in a room, and one, the family was always there. They visited, and the other guy was all by himself. And then I said to one of the aides, "This man is all alone. There's nobody, no pictures, no anything. Oh, he just an old faggot, and his boyfriend died." So that needs to be said, okay? Be very careful. And we visited at least four other places, senior residences. And I just bring that up to make the point that there's still not even tolerance in some cases. And what's being taught in the home, I think, has a lot to do with it, too. Seeing your parents and hearing your parents and what they have to say.
So I want to challenge this a little bit, Evan, because my experience has not been as positive in terms of people that I know. A lot of it has to do with economics. And also a lot of it has to do with skin color. When you look at senior living places, they're very segregated. You don't find as many residents of means. There are structural, systemic reasons for that. I find that also that if your gender expression is a little different from the ordinary, I would question how many staff people in the senior residences and the nursing homes and the various facilities are out and open and celebrated for being gay. There are just so many issues. Geography is another issue, too. If you have means, then you can afford to be in places that are more in the suburbs. For me, I would be looking for a place that's in the heart of downtown. I would be looking for a place that has amenities that I can walk to. I want an intergenerational kind of living arrangement. I want the kind of home setting which is developed on universal design, which means there are no steps, that there means the counters can be adjustable, all kinds of things that could make it easier for me to stay in place or stay in community. I find that the people that I visit are discouraged and tend to be private about their sexual orientation, especially if they're not partnered. They've lost a partner. They may have spent most of their lives struggling with being accepted for being gay. And if they then move to a senior living place or a skilled nursing facility, they may not have the choice. And they see how other people are regarded and treated, and so they tend to isolate and close down. And that's a terrible way to have to spend the remaining years of your lives when you want a life that's going to be as fulfilling and as meaningful as possible.
Well, we often ask, Steve, about the kind of mechanisms that will change things like that. And there's broadly speaking, there's two categories. There's regulatory or government rules, laws, et cetera, and then there's cultural changes. What's going to change some of the discouragement, the concern that the people you're talking to are feeling about making choices about their own housing?
Well, I think we need to see, we as a larger community and also within the LGBTQ community, need to see very concrete ways that people are welcomed, valued, and respected. And first of all, if we see staff people who present as gay are allowed to wear types of clothing or dress which are unique and stylish in their own way, then that is one cue that makes us say, ah, this could be a place for me. I think that there are a number of things that could be done that would include intergenerational exposure. The senior living places tend to be rather isolated. And if you have family coming to visit you, that's one thing. But I know that in some places, childcare centers are located next to senior centers so that the grandparents have an opportunity to be exposed to little kids and bring joy back into their lives. But I just think that the more opportunities that people have to remain in control of their lives and make decisions that are right for them will ultimately benefit all of us, regardless of the different identities that we carry.
And Steve, if I could just ask you to respond to some of what we heard from Sandra regarding this idea that sometimes in society we see a movement to create sort of our own separated communities, a separate community that might feel like a natural move to either avoid discrimination or just, you know, sort of people sort of gravitate towards similar. But she and her partner went to Florida, kind of checked out this lesbian community and said, it's great. It's just not for us. We want diversity. We don't want to just be among other lesbians. We want to be among people from all different backgrounds of life. That's important to us. And I mean, I take that point. I mean, I really do. What do you see towards what is sort of the ideal set of options? Is it the kind of options that says you live where you want to live? The options are here. You don't have to separate out of society where the inclusion looks like opportunity everywhere. You agree with that?
Definitely. And I think that's one of the unique things about Rochester that puts us moves us up on the progressive scale. And that is, where is the gay community in Rochester? Is there a particular location? There really isn't. You can live anywhere in Rochester, generally speaking, and be open and comfortable being gay. So there is no kind of like gay quarter, or somebody moves into town and says, gee, where can I feel comfortable living? For the most part, we can say we can feel comfortable living almost anywhere. And that is a credit to Rochester and the work of many people who came before us.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm originally from Cleveland. I certainly know growing up there, you know, there's certain suburbs and communities where, this is, sort of the gay community. I guess I've never thought about that in Rochester. There really isn't.
That's heterosexual privilege.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
I own that.
Yeah.
But I'm also saying that I don't think I'm aware of what that would even look like in Rochester, only because, to your point, it's not sort of just a segregated community that I'm aware of, at least.
And that's the kind of senior elder community I want to be part of, one that I could be. It wouldn't matter where I was, that I would be able to feel that.
You want to? Yeah, go ahead.
If I could speak to one thing with that. So I'm originally from Chicago, and Chicago developed in the Boys Town neighborhood a new senior living, it was independent living facility. And because it was aimed at all income levels, there was no way that they could say this is just an LGBTQ community. And so when they opened up the slots for the 88 apartments, they had something like, I believe it was 1,500 applications. It's not so much that there is not enough LGBTQ senior housing. There's not enough senior housing, safe environments in the country. So, absolutely, we need to make sure that there are more choices available to people. I don't think anyone wants to be the only place that LGBTQ people would be safe to go to, because that is just one aspect of someone's identity. There's so many other pieces that make up who they are, who they want to be. You need to have choice. You need to try and make sure that as many places as possible are along on that journey to make it a better environment for people.
Before I grab a phone call, let me flip the point that Steve was making about places or communities where gay couples, LGBTQ plus couples, or people can feel comfortable living versus where you might know you're not going to feel comfortable living. Sandra's referencing geography. Generally speaking, the farther south she goes, the less likely she feels that she's going to feel full inclusion. Do you feel that in this country there's still an urban-rural divide, Steve?
Most definitely, and it's right here around Rochester. We know from other examples of discrimination that many groups get targeted the further further away from the city that you get. And I think it's just due to lack of exposure. And when you have lacks of exposure, the stereotypes and the misinformation continue to play out.
But to state the obvious, there are LGBTQ people everywhere. And I'm thinking of the challenges they must face if, you know, I'm certainly not doubting what you're putting forward here, and how difficult that must be in rural communities then, even still today in 2020.
It's definitely true. And this whole idea of coming out, even though we may have been out for 30, 40, 50 years, every time we walk into an environment, we're always looking around to say, is this an environment where it's safe enough to be me? Can I share all of who I am in this particular environment? So it's an ever-ending cycle that we make the conscious choice when we decide to do so to say, yes, I'm going to be who I am in this environment. And we'd like to be able to say, hell be damned, but there's a lot of consequences when we do this.
Sure. Sandra, do you think there's an urban-rural divide, too, to where you're going to find inclusion?
That's a hard question. I raised my family in a little town in down on the southern tier, and it was my daughter said, Mom, how come two men live in that house? And I had to explain to her that there are differences in people, and we have to choose who we love, and that's the most important thing, is the love. So that being said, I can't say 100% if there is or isn't. Small cities, villages, I'd like to hope that there is some inclusion being started, but it's still a toss-up.
Okay. Nate, do you see that divide?
I would say that I think that I do. Previous to working at St. John's, I was working at a primary care clinic that focused on the LGBT community in the Baltimore region. And for especially the transgender community, the distance mm-hmm. that people would have to travel mm-hmm. for primary care, for proper support in transitioning, to find a supportive counselor or therapist, if they sought that out, there's just not as many resources out in more rural areas. And I think that just, it isn't a value judgment on rural areas. It's just they're differently resourced because there's fewer people.
Let me get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to your phone calls. Bonnie, hang there. We'll get some more of your feedback as we talk about housing opportunities, in particular for LGBTQ plus Americans, and the challenges, discrimination, but also some of the progress that we're seeing. You just heard Nate Sweeney, who's Vice President of Skilled Services at St. John's Home, a resident of the St. John's Meadows. Sandra Eamon is here, and Steve DeRose is Executive Director of the National Coalition Building Institute in Rochester. We'll get that break and come back to your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, as New York State revives a debate about high-speed rail, we'll have a debate among our panelists. Can New York State afford high-speed rail? Can we afford not to pursue it? That conversation first hour. Then in our second hour, the team from This Old House is coming to Rochester. WXXI helping host a live event, but first you'll hear them on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To your feedback we go. Bonnie in Rochester first. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. My first inclination for calling it, some of the other speakers have already addressed it, but I just want to reinforce again, while, you know, for housing, you know, it's not unusual for any group of people to have certain needs, maybe more skill on certain things that they are, you know, having some health-related problems for. But beyond that, this issue of diversity, I can't stress enough. It's not just because, oh, it feels good to be diverse, isn't that nice? It really has a lot to do with the political problems, both economic and discriminatory, that we see in this city, for sure, and many other cities, I would say all. All you have to do is go back and look at the history of housing in general and all that means. And when you go to solve some problems and make things more diverse, you run into this problem constantly. So you may have an idea of, well, let's have more diversity. Then you find economic problems because the way it's segregated is, you know, all the used to be rich and kind of half rich now live in one place, essentially. I take the bus all the time, and I can tell you where you live by what route you're taking in that bus, by what number of bus you get on. And so we have to, I think, in these issues of people who have any kind of different lifestyle, whether that be a racial issue, whether it be whatever, that we need to join together to work on these solutions. Because we have now some changes in the housing laws that have been helpful, and we have a tenants group that mainly is focused on people with low income. But we need to come together on this because it affects everybody. All the discussions I've heard so far, people who have more money obviously have more choices. People who don't are really stuck regardless of what other condition you or life situation you face. So we can't have, you know, Group A having to carry all the burden of economic struggle, and then other groups just, well, we have a little bit of a struggle, but we don't have to deal with that. The second thing I would say is some of the problem comes from because we have not enforced some of the funding programs and the legal things that carry with them. Example, Section 8 and DSS recipients cannot be discriminated against by a landlord for we're not going to take your application. That until very, very recently, still isn't enforced even now, a practice and an orientation locally that has been in the books for years has never really been enforced. And I can tell you firsthand because I, you know, have some experience in interfacing with people with housing issues. So how can we even, you know, say we're going to do something, major changes, if we don't even have the fundamentals down? And it takes guts because I've run up against landlords who say to me, when I say to them, you know, you posted something the other day because I saw it that said no DSS and no Section 8. And the guy says back to me, are you trying to challenge me? I said, well, you know what? I'm challenging you and the law. The law says, but they, you know, they don't feel any. Now, I think that's going to change somewhat because some of us have really been pushing this. But I use that as an example. You want diversity and the best of it. You don't want economic. You all rich live here and you all poor live there, which has been the model. So that has to be dealt with. So coming together of people who are in these situations, you know, in case of the LGBTQ we're talking about, same thing. We can't have people who are, you know, more fortunate go, well, I got my thing, and so too bad for you. That may sound a little harsh. I don't think all of people think that way, but we need to start joining in these situations, which are often not very mixed themselves. You know, you've got more, the poor people are kind of, here you are, and here's your struggle, and figure what you're going to do. Others, you know, we have some new housing things coming up for rent stabilization and all those things. We need to see these other people that we're talking about today in these discussions, sure, not off someplace. So thanks for listening. Oh, by the way, one of the reasons Steve Jaros and I get similar talk here is because we also share the same work site for people with disabilities with similar issues for years. So thank you.
Bonnie, thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie.
So you've heard that passion from her before, I suspect.
Definitely, and it's not in any one area.
Yeah. No. So a lot there. So why don't you start, Steve? What do you make of some of what you heard there?
Boy, there's so much to be said. I think the intersection of race and class is so apparent. First of all, in our panel today, we are three white people. We are three white people who are professional, have professional backgrounds. The gay rights movement has been visibly led by whites, affluent whites who had the power, the control, the language, the chutzpah to be able to be out in the trenches because they didn't have to work or find childcare or whatever the other issue was. We have neglected and ignored other elements of the gay community, especially around issues of class and race. And we might get a completely different take on issues around housing and openness and acceptance of people who identify as LGBTQ if we had a different panel here today. That's the only point I want to make.
Okay, Sandra?
I have a point. I was just sitting here considering, and no one has mentioned the gay deaf community. And I'm just bringing that forward to see what people might feel about that, because I do know gay deaf people.
I appreciate that, and I would think just another, certainly when we talk intersectionality, that's, I know that that term for some rankles, but part of what Sandra is raising is discrimination comes in different forms, and it is more challenging people in different ways. What do you think, Nate?
I completely agree. I think I don't think we've gotten to a place where we have an LGBT community. We tend to have LGBT communities scattered all across the country in different cities and different rural areas where people come together, and it's not one large group with complete agreement on everything. And those different factions of the communities have different needs because they're facing different challenges. And it's naive to think that the challenges I face as a cisgender gay white man are anything close to what other people are facing. You have to remember that. And you also have to keep moving things forward as best you can. You know, kind of speaking to one of the things that the caller was talking about, a lot of the activism around housing tends to focus on people who there's great strides that have been made for the disability community, great strides made for low-income people. But again, I would argue that older folks get left out a lot of those that work. I had a wonderful mentor once who said, if your movement is not intergenerational, it's just a scene, which I thought was a really lovely statement.
Yeah. Let me read a couple of emails. Jerry wants to know, are there attorneys who specialize in anti-gay discrimination cases? I don't know the answer to that. Steve, do you know?
I personally don't, but I would say call the Out Alliance, and they have a resource list. And
I
that
suspect
would be
they
a
would.
great avenue to find that out.
Call the Out Alliance if you need help there. That's a great place to start. Amy writes to say, Evan, I'm often asked by friends around the country and from England who ask why I don't live in New York City as a woman who happens to be transgender. My reply is, I feel safer in Rochester. I have excellent health care at Trillium, and it's a lot less expensive to live here. So we are fortunate to live where we do as LGBTQIA persons. And by living our lives out and proud, we help others accept us for who we are. That's from Amy. Let me ask Sandra for a take on that, because, again, you know, you came out, you said when you were 52, and everyone's sort of own personal story is different. The timing of when they sort of self-identify, decide to live openly, as Amy talks about. Do you agree with Amy that living out and proud helps others to start accepting?
Definitely. And I have to say this. My son has been gay since he's 16. And when I came out...
He's probably always gay. But...
He was delighted. Right, right, right. But he was delighted. And he took me around Rochester and showed me there was at one time a bookstore here. And he said, don't go into that club because they'll eat you alive. They're biker dykes. So anyway, I got an education for my son. And... Well, it is what it is. Okay. So, yes, Rochester, I feel, is a safe place to be. Coming out is a tough thing. My family, anyway, that's a long story for a rainy night by the fireside. I think she's right. And what do you do? How do you do it? Who do you do it to and with? Go figure.
Yeah, and I would just say to Amy, whom we've gotten to know through the program, you know, Amy, thanks for the email and much love. And I try to sort of, as Nate was just saying, sort of check myself before I kind of lecture others on how they're going to, you know, come out, when to come out. Though I take Amy's point that generally speaking, if you can do that, it may help others in many different ways. But I'm just more sort of observing that conversation. You want to add to that, Steve and Nate? Yeah, Steve?
Sure. When I was a young person in the 50s and early 60s, there were no role models. There was no guidance person or a clergy person or my own family that I could feel comfortable sharing my feelings. Certainly that through tumultuous times in the last 50, 60 years, that has become better, but it's never easy when it's your turn to decide whether to come out and how often.
Okay, Nate?
Just to echo that, I mean, I'm 41 years old. The ability that I have to be out in the workplace, the ability that I have to be out to my family completely rests on people who came out earlier, who took those brave steps to be out and proud and to change our culture and to also change the laws and to change protections. That, you know, I think a lot of people my age and younger really forget that. And I think a large part of that is due to the HIV epidemic that took place in the 80s. We lost an entire generation of LGBTQ folks. And so much of that history got lost. And so much of that trauma is still there for people. And, you know, that really impacts housing as well, because you're talking about folks who were caregivers for other people in their community, cared for people they barely knew. But that lasting piece around caregiving changes the way that people think about staying independent, and it changes the way that people think about needing help, having a supportive environment, having a supportive community. And I think there's a lasting legacy that is part of the conversation.
Well, we're down to our last few minutes. And by the way, to the point that you know, Nate's raising there, Megan Mack and I have mentioned a number of times we happen to be fans of the show Will and Grace. And on the newest iteration of the show, its comeback, you know, in the first season back, Will, who's got to be around 50 now, though Eric McCormack looks like he doesn't age, and I don't know what's happening in his life that allows that. But he was dating a guy who was in his 20s, and the relationship sort of sours when his 20-something boyfriend kind of wasn't even aware of gay history and some of the movement. And he starts lecturing his boyfriend on, like, hey, you're standing on the shoulders of the work that we've done here. I mean, and I know it can be sensitive, but I think what we're seeing in, you know, multiple generations on this program today is there is a lot of appreciation that it hasn't, that it's not that it's easy now, but progress is, you know, changes, looks like different things in different places. And the question is, where do you go next? So if you're wondering about options, I want to ask Nate before we go, if you want to get in touch with, for example, St. John's and learn about options, how do they do that?
Sure. The easiest way to learn about St. John's would be to go to our website, which is stjohnsliving.org. That has information about all the different levels of care that we provide. If people are looking for more national resources, SAGE, which is sageusa.org, has a lot of information, as does the National Resource Center on LGBT Aging, which is lgbtaging.org. Those those are great starting points for navigating out. If you're a social service provider, if you're a medical professional, how you can start to find resources that touch into your own career place and your own work, as well as housing and some of the resource guides that exist to make your environments more welcoming, more friendly.
Okay. Steve, where would you direct people to either learn more or kind of continue this conversation and talk about progress?
I would say that there are many gay people. When I say gay, I'm using the generic term
yep.
for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, intersex, asexual, et cetera, et cetera. There are many people in your midst. Talk to people. Find out what their issues are. If there are people in your families or in your workplaces and you do not have a relationship with them, you get to ask yourself, why is it that I'm not engaging? What is it about me rather than what is it about them that's keeping me from getting into a great conversation?
Okay. Sandra, you got a bridge game this weekend?
I do have a bridge game this weekend. To no Trump.
To no Trump?
Yeah.
Is that a bid?
It is a bid.
Is that a political statement?
Yes. Everything is a political statement. It depends on how you hear it, right?
For a moment, I didn't know what you were saying because my father, who's a bridge player, would be disappointed that I didn't recognize that was a bid.
Oh, be prepared.
Hey, it's been really lovely meeting you and hearing
Thank
your story.
You.
Thank you for being here.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'll come again anytime.
Sandra Eamon. Megan Mack, she says she'll come back anytime, Sandra Eamon. So we always appreciate great conversationalists like Sandra, Nate Sweeney, Vice President of Skilled Services at St. John's Home. Thanks for what you do.
Absolutely. Thank you for having
us here. And Steve Giroux, Executive Director of the National Coalition Building Institute in Rochester. Thank you. Our thanks to Tim Shea. Outstanding work today. And much love to you, Tim. All the great work he does as a volunteer for us today. Thank you. Come back, we hope. Megan Mack is producing and engineering. She is remarkable at what she does. We got a great team here. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you are surrounded by those you love and those who love you this weekend. And we'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.